My two favorite forms of entertainment are reading books and watching films. Not surprisingly, both mediums hold the same basic concepts for presenting a story, which are a beginning, some rising action, and a resolution. However, for those times when a story is both a movie and a book, I, like many other folks, will often choose the latter. It's not that I don't appreciate the visual interpretation of a story, but in many cases, the complexity of the author's original meaning for that story is frequently muddled in translation. This analogy reflects how I feel sometimes when I watch mainstream movies based on African American experiences. For all intents and purposes, some of these movies may present some parts of our imagery, but often fail to capture the entirety of our narrative. Of course, that all depends upon who's authoring the story. I was reminded of this recently when I attended the 100 Years in Black Film panel discussion, which was held through the Oscar Micheaux Film Festival, happening this month on the campus of Temple University. The panel, which was moderated by young filmmaker Chinua Achiuku, features author and Villanova adjunct professor John King and Dr. Michelle Parkinson, award-winning filmmaker of such works as Sweet Honey on the Rocks, in addition to being an assistant professor in film and media arts at Temple. Both were there to give their impressions on the Black filmmaking tradition and the commitment to truth-telling and representation of Black life, history, and culture. What you'll hear next is excerpts from that discussion. As you listen, reflect on how Black filmmakers' goal of reflecting true images of African American on the big screen has evolved over time.
So our panelists will begin by sharing their opening thoughts about these topics and issues, and then I'm going to facilitate the discussion by asking a few specific questions. After they've had a chance to respond to them, I'll then open it up to the entire audience so we can all continue to dialogue about what was stated and any new questions, comments, and reflections. So if we can begin, Mr. King, if you can go ahead and share some opening thoughts, remarks, comments, reflections, and then follow by Mr. Parker.
The one thing that I wanted to say is different about 100 years of film, specifically Africans in film, is looking at the time. The trajectory is important. Understanding the context is important. So what came to mind, or who came to mind specifically, was Dr. Du Bois. I'm thinking about what Dr. Du Bois said about the 20th century. And he said that this century would be the problem of the 20th century would be the problem of color lines. And so when you look at it in that context, what we saw makes a lot of sense. At the time, we were talking about the emergence of the New Negro, the emergence of the NAACP, Pan-African movement. So Africans were on the move. We were progressing. Yet you had directors, Thomas Edison, B.W. Griffin, who wanted to maintain the status quo and the notion, at least on celluloid, that we hadn't left the plantation. So the race film, as it is titled, starting with Oscar Micheaux, becomes important. To quote this from Tony K. Bambara, what the race film does is it affirms race people, it affirms race program, it affirms our culture, affirms our narrative. And so that is the initial intention of the race film, to affirm African culture. Now, it didn't always do that. It certainly reared off. It certainly, once it became very popular in Hollywood, decided to put their hand into it. And so we began to see things that we had already seen before with Thomas Edison, E.W. Griffin. These archetypes of Mammy, Sambo, Uncle Tom, Coon, Brute, the Buck, the tragic mulatto as was portrayed here. All of these archetypes that allows others to justify our inhumanity. And so we were doing a lot of things in terms of making film. We were not that we needed to justify our humanity, but we were affirming our humanity and affirming our culture.
I grew up in an era when black people on the screen was a rarity. This was a rarity. When the black image on the screen in movies or on television was not to be taken for granted. As a child of the 1950s, I came from a generation whose parents would call friends and family if word got out that any black person, being a performer, a politician, or civil rights activist, etc., was going to be on TV that evening. This gave me some early inkling of the power of film and television. The fact that thousands of people across the country could witness the same moment, the same history, the same stories at the same time. But what does this marvel of the electronic age mean to younger generations of the digital age, for whom the availability of diverse media images, immediate global access and communication, and viral information are taken as second nature? Growing up, it was the movies that beguiled me the most. The screen size and scale, the shared viewing experience in a darkened theater with hundreds of strangers were magic to me, a magic I wanted to partake in as often as possible, and a magic that I wanted to learn how to conjure as a filmmaker, because it also occurred to me early on in this process that making these images was the real power to be had. The panel and the screenings that are part and parcel of the second annual Oscar and Show Film Festival create an academic and community forum for us to better understand what we have enjoyed in the first 100 years of blacks in film and why, and conversely, what has enraged us and why. This is an arena for us to discuss the production devices and technological advancements which shaped the content, the stories of the black experience within the context of their times. Even during those early years of my TV watching and movie going experience, I was struggling to sort out the incongruities of what I was viewing, what those images were saying to the world about my race, my gender, my dreams. One of the reasons I became a filmmaker and a major part of my fascination with film history was to try to clear up these disparities. The renowned black film historian Donald Vogel concisely states this idea. He says, quote, "I wondered as I watched on television a broadcast of the original 1934 version of Imitation of Life, what effect this movie had had on the black community when it was first released. Moreover, what had happened to the actress, Freddie Washington, who had touched a national nerve when she played Piola, a discontent, light-skinned beauty who passes for white? Why, too, had Paul Robeson appeared in so many films made abroad? What were the lessons for contemporary filmmakers in examining the career of pioneering black film director Oscar Michaud, who has, as has been stated earlier, started producing, directing, writing, and distributing motion pictures in the silent era, and continued working on his own outside of the Hollywood system into the late 1940s? Why was it that Dorothy Dandridge, after her Oscar-nominated success in Carmen Jones, did not appear in another film for almost another 3 years? Had Spencer Williams, who starred as Andy Brown in the 1950s TV series Amos and Andy, actually once directed all black movies in the 30s and 40s? Why were the TV series like I Spy, Julia, East Side, West Side considered such groundbreaking programs in the 1960s? The subject of blacks in American film and television was, for the most part, undocumented when I was growing up, and sadly, there is still not enough information on the subject today, end quote.
So both of you have already kind of touched on this kind of historical trajectory and some very, you listed some very important names and works. In the history of black cinema and black cinema. But if you can go ahead and specifically talk about some of the most pivotal moments in history, in American history, some pivotal films and filmmakers that were critical in shaping black cinema and blacks in cinema in the past 100 years that have directly affected how the state of black cinema today.
Well, I think one of the earlier titles that may be referenced is Birth of a Race, which was a cinematic response undertaken by Emmett J. Scott, who was a protege of Booker T. Washington, in response to Birth of a Nation. It was, in a sense, the first step in self-determination by African to adjust the kinds of injustices that we were just beginning to and were going to still do suffer on screen in terms of stereotypes, and also stereotypes that were played upon us by, as you noted, Nashay, white people in blackface up until a certain point in history. Then there is the advent of sound, which also induced Hollywood to welcome us into the fold because we could sing, we could dance, we had great voices, and we were great for this new technology. And so the early soundies, as they were called, Hallelujah, Hearts and Dixie, undertaken by Fox Studios, etc., were the first entree for mainstream images of in all black cast musicals of black people in that particular turn in the technology pivot in the Hollywood machine.
I agree with Dr. Parkinson. Certainly, Rebirth of the Nation. Within our gates, what was shown, 1920, the narrative of this film is important because it really deals with, we're talking about truth telling. Now, here we are in an age of lynching, and we know what the major excuse was for lynchings, was that, you know, black man looked at, thought about looking at, spoke to, or raped a white woman. Within Our Gates tells a story, if you go into the entirety of the film, of a white man who's actually shot, and he's thought to be shot by this black man who's an employee of his. His brother goes back and seeks revenge on the gentleman who's thought to have killed his brother, this white man, and attempts to rape this young lady he comes upon. Well, the only thing that stops him at the time is that he notices a birthmark on her that is a familial birthmark. So it indicates to him that this is his child. So he's essentially raping his child. So what Michelle was trying to do in this film was to really sort of set the record straight in terms of rape. In terms of who was actually being raped and who was raping who, you know. So I think it's a monumental, it's an important film in terms of our history in this period. But it didn't get a lot of showing, I don't believe.
Yeah, it was not widely distributed. There are other Michelle titles that received larger exhibitions. Body and Soul with Paul Robeson is one example. One of his early apprenticeship movies, so to speak. I also think during that period as well, you saw race uplift movies, as they were called at the time, again, around right before soundies came in. One of the most beautiful films I've ever seen of the race, early race movie genre, is Scar of Shame by the Colored Players of Philadelphia. It was shot right here in North Philadelphia and in Morristown, New Jersey. And the production values of this film are gorgeous. The performances, the editing, the production design, the sophisticated storyline. We were capable of duplicating what was available coming out of Hollywood. Also, movies were in their infancy as well. We were able to replicate or even best some of the high quality images and structures that were coming out of Hollywood at that time. So there are a range
race movies have a range of aesthetic qualities. Some you would dare not, you get through it and you figure how did I make that. Oscar Michel was famous for, especially when money was low, re-editing movies and reconfiguring scenes and putting them out under a new title. So he could continue to distribute and get some money and move on to the next thing or raise money for the next film. So that it's an interesting, race movies alone could be the content of this panel. Absolutely. And we're trying to cover 100 years of slaves. So, John, how about you, other gentlemen?
Well, I like to piggyback again off of you, what you just said. The film Star of Change was considered a moral play or moral movie. We are familiar with those. And I know I don't want to touch Tyler Perry, because I know you all are going to touch Tyler Perry.
I just see a little bit.
But Tyler started with that genre, really, the stuff that he was doing in theater houses, basically moral plays. And I don't know if people sort of gotten that, and we sort of fell off of what the intent was in terms of teaching because of the comedy relief that actually sort of overshadows the moral plays now. But that's sort of where he borrowed from, so we can see literally the shoulders that he's standing on.
All right, what are those other pivotal moments, pivotal films or filmmakers that you think have directly contributed to the state of Black cinema today?
I think another pivotal period, because the 70s are closer to us, lots of us have seen either the blaxploitation or the black themed films, which I want to differentiate. They're all not one thing. That of black movies called blaxploitation, and that it covers a variety of aesthetics and themes. But in the 40s, the late 40s, particularly right after World War II, there was the so-called social problem film genre, in which the issue of racism was now being discussed or breached by Hollywood filmmakers. Intruder in the Dust, Lost Boundaries, Home of the Brave with James Edwards. This was a period of time in which brothers were returning from World War II. They were returning to a renewed entrenchment of discrimination here in this country. And so there was a response from Hollywood in terms of the American awareness and friction and pressure that was going on at the time. So these were the first efforts of Hollywood to kind of talk about it. And A Pinky was another one in which Jean Crane, very beautiful white actress, got the role of a mulatto's sister who is trying to figure out whether she can become a nurse, whether she can marry her boyfriend who is white, whether she should come out to him as Negro. Her mother is black. Ethel Waters is her mother. And so it's social problem and race problem in a lot of contexts. Home of the Brave deals with war stress, post-traumatic syndrome following the war around a racist incident that happens in the trenches. Intruder in the Dust is a very interesting film with Juano Hernandez. I love the actors because that's another part of the thing too, is the performers and how many of them lifted up some of the kind of trenchant, formulaic material they got to a really high level of performance. Juan Hernandez is the owner of his property, and a white boy breaches his ranch area. A crime happens, and there are problems, which immediately they want to blame the black man for the problems when, in fact, and the white boy is going to be, hey, this is fine. So I think that's another period of the social problem issues. The 70s were very interesting because of the range of types of black things that were happening when Hollywood discovered that, hey, you know what, black producers created the box office and this is what we're about. And black independent filmmakers fired up behind the black power movement, the cultural nationalist movement, took the tools of image making, which is what I was trying to discuss here, and said, you know what, we need to put some verisimilitude up on the screen about us. We need to make movies about ourselves. And there was a wide range of films here as well. You had, and filmmakers, from Charles Burnett to Kathleen Collins to documentary makers like Bill Miles and William Greaves. There was a whole international black cinema movement that was happening with the international success of works by Usman and Ben, Sarah Muldura, and in the 80s, Suzanne Palsy, who did two films you might have seen, Sugarcane Alley and A Dry White Season, which deals with apartheid, which dealt with the 10 Hollywood stars, Susan Sarandon, Donald Sutherland. So you're seeing that filmmakers were not just working with small cameras, working in isolation. There were a variety of people who did that, who got the equipment and did their independent thing. There were other filmmakers who made their way and used the power of the studio system to make new ways of reinventing our image or projecting a truer image of ourselves on screen, in conjunction with the Sounders, the Shafts, the Sparkles, the Lady Sings the Blues, that were also a part of ours at the same time period in the 70s.
That's a lot of food for thought from the panelists. You'll hear more from them later on in the show, but first I want to introduce you to two young filmmakers I have encountered recently during the screening of their work. The first is Naeemu Lowe, director of her short, Birthmark, which is an experimental nonfiction film about how her father, Bill Lowe, was attacked by the police during the Newark riots in 1967. Followed up by Maya Shipman, aka Susie Analog, director of another short film called 33 Queen, which chronicles the rise of Komo Chi, a leader in the female hip-hop movement in Tokyo, Japan. I feel that both of these filmmakers represent a growing movement of young people redefining black imagery both in front and behind the camera. Tell us a little bit about the film and why you decided to do this.
Well, I'd had the idea for making the film for a long time. Always had the idea, the central idea of wanting to somehow document the scars that he had on his back, which is the sort of central idea of this film, since I was young, and had always worked as a writer. But then when I sort of had the chance to learn and grow in film, I thought it would be great to create something that sort of revolved around that, and all I had to do was sort of get his permission to be willing to take part, and he was. So I started it in late 2005 and finally finished up in 2007, but yeah.
Growing up, did you always know the meaning behind the scars? Or?
Not entirely. I mean, I guess I did from when I was, from about when I was six until the film, I mean, as the film says, until I was an adult. But before then, when I was younger, I thought of them as, you know, just these marks that I didn't fully understand. And at that point, he and my mother explained to me what had happened and what they were about, and it became this really formative part of my my upbringing to be able to understand that this had happened, that the police had beat him up, and that you know, was a, I guess, formative experience in his life as well.
Trentonian reporter William Lowe was sent to New York late yesterday afternoon. He soon found himself in the midst of the story and the actions involved. Here is the eyewitness account. War was declared last night between police and Negro residents, and I saw the battle start. I was standing behind several speakers in front of the precinct door when the first bottle was hurled. It broke above my head, covering me with pieces of glass. I moved across the street with the crowd as they garaged the building and demolished a police car parked nearby before the enemy appeared. 20 minutes after the first assault, dozens of policemen rushed screaming from the building, dressed in riot helmets and building clothes indiscriminately. As policemen chased the residents into the apartment complex across the street, I stood down the street toward my car and never made it. Several policemen suspecting that I was an enemy stopped me and told me to move along. As I tried to explain that I was a Trentonian reporter, one of them grabbed me by the arm and struck me on the leg with his club. As I fell to the ground, when they paused for breath and managed to extract my wallet and get out of the restaurant. I showed it to them as they loomed over me. Don't show me anything. It's not important, said the cop. I started hitting me again.
How was it for you and your father to, I guess, revisit it?
You know, I was nervous about asking him to do the film. I thought he would, you know, think it was strange or exploitative or something, but he was excited to do it. He had talked about how, for him, he had never actually seen, really gotten a chance to see the scars himself because of their location, and so he was excited for a chance to really be able to get some perspective on it. And working together on the film was really great. It was just a chance for us to spend kind of a lot of time together and do something creative together. I think I was more sort of nervous and had more sort of intense feelings about it than he did. I think he had felt that he had put to rest whatever sort of hard feelings he had about the experience, when I, you know, felt sort of nervous and scared and confused about what it was, the kind of return to, you know, we shot a lot of stuff back in Newark where the riots had happened, and so it was really, you know, for me it felt really emotional, but I think for him, he just sort of appreciated the chance to kind of help me figure it out.
It's a really great short film. Have you shown it anywhere else?
Yeah, I've shown it quite a bit. It screened quite a bit in 2007 and early 2008 in Newark, actually, Newark Black Film Festival. I won an award for Best Experimental Film. It screened as part of the Student Academy Awards. It screened a bunch of different festivals, some overseas, some here in the States. I've done some, you know, the sort of premiere screening was one that I did sort of locally here in Philadelphia back in, I guess it was late 2007. So, yeah, I screened it.
Is this your first film, or?
Yeah, it is.
Are you working on anything now?
I am. In addition to being a filmmaker, I also do other kinds of work, sort of, also sort of more experimental work. So I'm working on one that's actually about Richard Simmons right now.
Oh, nice.
which is like a performance video piece.
Is he going to be in it?
No, well, not directly. I don't think I don't know if I have the nerve to go and talk to him about it. And then I've actually been thinking, and this is like way just sort of at the back of my mind, but doing something that's sort of like a reflection or adaptation, not a direct one, but a vague sort of reflection adaptation of Invisible Man, Ralph Ellison.
Okay.
So, oh, I love it. It wouldn't be like sort of a direct thing, but sort of maybe a response to the novel. So that's what I'm up to.
If people want to see it or get in contact with you or just find out more information about your
website, so it's www.naimalowe.com, so NAIMALOWE.com, and there's everything you would need to know about my work is on the site.
Okay, thank you very much for joining us.
She's 24, Japanese, and arguably the number one female rapper in Japan. While Japanese hip-hop shares a common ethnic background in Japan's largely homogeneous culture, it was only a matter of time before the issue of gender were to rear its head.
If you're familiar with Rich Medina or many of my affiliate artists have actually worked with Jack before. So when I went to Japan, I was very interested in getting to know them. They have a job as well as a label. So I was really lost for like 3 hours, but I found their record shop. I'm also a musician, so I gave them my music. They told me to come to a record release, which actually had some friends of mine on the release. So from LA. So when I went to the release, I had something, I think I had a bag on or something that Kamaji came up to me and said, "Who are you? What are you wearing? Like, what do you do?" I said, "Oh, I'm a producer. I'm making a film and I'm also a musician." Ever since then, we have hung out like every single week. So I went from just me becoming my subject to becoming my friend. And we visited many times since then. She's come and stayed with me out in LA. Yeah, it's been a really good experience. I've learned a lot about myself through her. And I learned a lot about the United States too, because I never knew that you could take two people who never knew each other before in two different countries who speak two different languages, and I'm really not that great at Japanese, but we found so many commonalities from experiences that we've had since we just got to like favorite records, favorite clothes, everything.
A hip-hop's meaning changed in the last. It gave birth to a new meaning around the globe. Starting in the 90s, hip-hop in Japan became popular in clubs, with crossover artists like Takashi Kano and Shibata Haruoka being the center. As more media options emerged in Japanese culture, events like breakdance and MC bands became sponsored by DJ equipment companies and other sites. Live hip-hop acts like the Joko Brothers, De La Soul, and Papa Nini began to travel to Japan. Hip-hop began to become extended to a broader reach of people. Becoming softer. Sometimes from working into expensive liquor false advertisements. Then the woman that did have the will to remain true to the legacy would find a dead end stops at being misnomered as underground. Events like this mark the death of the mainstream female athletes, what's to name after it went to do.
Were they? I feel like these ladies represent the future of Black filmmaking, but what do our panelists think about the prospects of Black picture making? We return back to our panel discussion to find out.
Do you think that there is a Black film aesthetic today? And if so, what does it look like? How has it changed over the years? If not, why do you think that is? Also, another part of that is, how do we as filmmakers and the audience navigate through these kind of identity politics?
I think there could be. I think it's rather tricky. I think Black film aesthetic for Black viewers, for us, has the components of things that are familiar to us. Mm-hmm. Spirituality, music. And we know certainly from the 70s that the films that were for us important were music that were soundtracks that were driving the film.
Yes.
You know, Curtis Mayfield's era, what I call it. But also looking at films like Julie Dash's Daughter of the Dust, you look at the cinematography and the beauty, how she has depicted this Gula tradition at this particular era, at this juncture of Black life in the early part of the 20th century. I mean, it's amazing. So all of those things, our use of color, of African color, the way that we view our lens, music, spirituality, all of that for me creates a Black film aesthetic.
Yes, I would agree with what John has said. I also think that we're in a new digital age in which the vertical integration system that the Hollywood machine, Dream Factory created, in which one makes the movies, owns the stars, owns the theaters in which the movies are screened, and owns the distribution network that markets and moves these movies around the country and around the globe, is now in a computer. When I was coming up as a filmmaker, we struggled going hard to get the money just to get the camera. We had to raise money to edit. These days, you guys open your Apples, you open your Macs, and the world of studio, the vertical integration system opens to you at your keypad. You can create, you can shoot, you can edit, you can market, you can stream, you can do all of these things that before were, you know, giant steps in the process of film production, the hegemony of film production. So I think that some of the certainties about Black film aesthetics need to be reimagined in the digital age. But on the other hand, will there be an avatar in the hood? What will that be? How will precious, what does precious portend?
Right.
for movies at this point, not just terms of thematically, image of black women on screen, image of sexuality on screen, but the way it was made, is this a new black aesthetic? But I think that I am beginning to wonder, beyond thematically, the theme and the content and sometimes the context of the film, what black cinema aesthetics mean now.
And kind of touching on this question and what we talked about before, what type of identity politics do you think that you had to navigate as a filmmaker? And this is opening up to you as well, Dr. King. What type of identity politics do you think that we as the viewer negotiate with as well? Especially thinking, and we'll definitely talk about this next week with Tyler Perry's films, but the relationship between viewer and film is so critical to, I think, to the success of his work. And so, and I think there has been like that history of call and response. Mm-hmm. So I think about what do we have to, what do we negotiate? What is our relationship as viewers of black film, what, and identity, and what, and as a, from a filmmaker's perspective, what type of identity politics do you think you navigate with your own film, whether it's from the marketing standpoint or even just from the creation and the conception standpoint?
Sure. I think from the standpoint of a viewer, which is probably the only thing that I can answer, there are a few things that are negotiated. I think in this so-called post-racial era that we're talking about, and I'll use Obsess as an example. It's a very good example. There certainly has been a shifting of roles, but I think the directors are very smart in terms of the seduction that they create. They seduce us with class orientation, you know, their cars, the vehicles, the house, so you know within the first 5 minutes who these folks are. They're professional people, they're the black bourgeoisie. And that's sort of the negotiation that happens, and then we buy in. If we're willing to, that's what we're looking for. And then we sort of get into the narrative. And I don't know if most of you have seen Obsessed. It's an interesting sort of turnabout. You know, we're talking about rape or seduction, and that the African male is being seduced by this white woman who is obsessed with him. And so they sort of turn the archetype on its side. But it's done at sort of negotiation or at risk of some of the other things that we're so used to as African people in terms of, our culture, our spirituality, what else is going on. You don't necessarily recognize those other things because we've exchanged them for all of the nice visuals of class. And so in terms of identity politics, I think that's a major one, the issue of class, and how it's being supplanted to sort of take us away from other issues that we might concern us as viewers, that might make a film authentic to us or feel authentic to us.
I think identity politics continues to be a struggle for getting, authentic and challenging and holistic images of black women on the screen. This continues to be a work in progress. It is being forwarded by those sisters who have persistence of vision as their mantra, who have tried to make stabs at it, like Casey Lemon, Julie Dash, obviously Maya Angelou to some extent. Now you've got new sisters on the scene like Gina Bodywood, Darnell Martin. Some of these sisters cut their teeth in music videos during the late 80s and 90s and moved into the studio system. Darnell Martin, Millicent Shelton. So I think that that is one area that is still in process, and I that's one of the particular areas of identity politics that I am committed to in terms of my own work. I also think in terms of a more holistic look at black sexuality, straight, gay, pansexual, otherwise, is also on the horizon. I think that sexuality has been one of those conservative pockets, particularly gay and lesbian identity, has been one of those conservative pockets for us as a people. And I think that you're seeing those dribs and drabs and sometimes featured representations of black gay and lesbian people and transgender people on screen. The Color Purple, certainly in the 80s, was one of those big landmark moments in which black women not only gained centrality in a Hollywood movie directed by Steven Spielberg, but based on the novel by Alice Walker, but you also had the issue of a lesbian romance going on there as well. And often in my work, this is foregrounded as well. As I'm shopping the script around now, I've encountered some very interesting responses to it, even though the work is set, the story is set in the Harlem Renaissance. It deals with the ordinary lives of people in Harlem during the Harlem Renaissance, with the great intellectuals and artists as backdrops to the daily lives of people. But there are also the issues of sexuality, issues of Pan-Africanism, and other things that were part and parcel of our existence at that time. That when people, as well as the fact that it's a historical drama, and people are like, oh, we don't do black historical. We can do urban all day. That's cheap. But you want a what, a Duesenberg? You need to block off the street and dress all these people in, you know, cloche hats and the music, and we've got to reconstruct it. Don't know, but we could do anything on urban. So I think that is a big, there are so many wonderful historical figures. Bessie Coleman, Bessie Coleman, the first black woman flyer. You know, just a lot of some of the stars we're talking about, Paul Robeson. A biopic of some of these actors alone would be amazing. But that still remains the great divide. We can do stuff contemporary. Can we get a soundtrack out of it? But I can surely see that Queen Latifah could play Bessie Smith. I surely see that Missy Elliott could play. You know, so it's about lining up ducks in a row when you're trying to sell a project like this and trying to push the fear of the, you know, Merchant Ivory historical drama thing out of their minds, because what's making money right now is what's happening right now. And it's young and it's urban, and that's what we're doing.
So finally, what new directions and possibilities do you think the future holds for black filmmakers and black representation on screen and behind the camera as well?
Well, I'm certainly encouraged by the number of young people black people coming out, and other filmmakers of color, young filmmakers of color, coming out of film schools or learning through media training programs like Scribe, video here, for example, who are learning the craft and who will be in the, you know, employment base of how movies get made. This is important. You know, we're not all aiming to be directors. We want to be excellent editors. We want to be the colors, people who color time, the prints that you see. Also, the way images are going to be projected now will be via satellite, not a projector. It will be coming, this will be beamed down, or you'll get a digital format of some kind. So as the technology changes, I want very much that people of color, women of color in particular, be involved in the making, the production process, in how films are made and how they're evolving in terms of not only production, but exhibition and distribution. We seem to be making great strides in terms of distribution. That was a hard one for us to crack, but we're there. We're marketers. We are heads of distribution companies. And now with the digital media, again, you can be a one-person distribution arm immediately. So I think that is one big piece of being in the future, is being part of the technology as it evolves.
I would hope that we expand the genres. I hear a lot of young filmmakers talking about making, and I have a story, making sci-fi films, making, we don't even have great suspense films. I'm an old fan of Al Hitchcock. You know, the mystery, things that, you know, we enjoy also. And so if we could, with all the collective monies that we have, find a way to break those barriers and just sort of flip that script and expand the genres of what is an African narrative in terms of storytelling. I hope that's where we want the direction.
Thank you. I'm gonna go ahead and open it up to everybody. There's a lot said, a lot of questions posed. by a panelist. So first, generally speaking, does anybody want to comment on what was said in the past 45 minutes? Can you just raise your hand? You can go ahead and call us.
My name is Chris. Before I came here tonight, I went over to that closed library with like the African, like Black History collection. First time I was there.
Right.
I asked her to see a Black Panther newsletter. She had a visual from the 1970s. Pull it out. I've looked at one before, but never like that. Like most of the headlines were like, "Kill the pigs" and "F capitalists." Pigs and capitalists, yeah, that was like the big thing. From your remarks, is it accurate that basically what you see as best for people is to kind of sell out best you can to this Hollywood machine, hope you get some distribution through your little thumbs that aren't going to really change anything, you know, especially down, I mean, I don't know, at least then they were pointing at the pigs, I'm not sure people know who the pigs are anymore. And I think like, you know, the assault of like BET, et cetera, is a lot deeper than people see, but I didn't really hear any opposition to that, and I don't want a little piece in the machine personally.
I think that's a very good point, and I think that's where we started at the opening, that looking at the trajectory of film with an inherent historical context. So what you were looking at in Watson was about the historical context. The films that Dr. Parkinson alluded to in terms of the late 1960s Black theme, Black action, what was titled Black Exploitation by the NAACP in LA, all of that was to at least put on the celluloid a message of empowerment, even if it wasn't in real time. And so, but it fit the historical messages, it fit what was going on, at least what we wanted to happen. And I think a lot of us are afraid. We're afraid that this is what Melvin Van Peebles will probably say when he comes here, that political message has been supplanted in exchange for some other things. And so there is a bit of selling out, but we're hoping that young filmmakers will bring back the political message, or at least there will be a politicalness to the film, because there's always a politicalness to African people. You know, in whatever decade you find us, there is a political message, be it apartheid, anti-apartheid movement, or just the exclusion of everybody, of our gay and lesbian community, of African people everywhere in the diaspora. So I agree with you.
Yeah, I agree with Dr. King. I think that there are a number of ways. You know, you're looking at the Panther magazine. I hope that the newspaper also quoted something about the breakfast program. But okay, there's like 12 steps in it, but anyway. Okay. That means I kept mine. Because I can remember the steps. My point is, the 70s were a time of overt, often flagrant political messages, which were needed at the time. Because everything was about the big push towards assimilation and, you know, the white man's ice is colder, so we need to go there. I think that some major things were lost, and I think maybe this might be revisionist of me, but there's something about the fact that as a community during segregation, we were supplying things for our own community because we had to, that the impetus in the 60s toward assimilation and integration made the need for more striving militancy come to the fore, because the big message that was being sold was integrate, assimilate, it's good, you know, more American, be more American than most Americans. And so I think that strivency, and I think that you were referring to in the Panther paper, is now being finessed with a 21st century kind of complication. There are still political needs and political references going on, but it's how they're presented. I don't know if you ever saw a film by Malcolm Lee, Spike Lee's cousin, called The Best Man. And would you have a group of young black men who are attending a wedding? But there is, it's the politics that are there, but they're still there. It's just how you present them in the story. It doesn't need to be, you know, off the pigs and what have you. But you can still do, if as needed, off the pigs in other ways.
So you both recommend selling out?
Oh, no, not at all.
Well, he said he did, actually, and you agreed with him. And I haven't heard anything.
Can you reference it? Can you bring that quote back to us?
Can you play that tape?
Well, why don't you ask someone else? Did anyone else hear him say
that?
You know, well, I mean, it's like, yeah, sure. Like, I mean, basically, it's like what? Let's see. Well, even apart from the remarks, it's the question. You recommend, you know, getting more distribution. You see as a victory greater distribution within the capitalist system to sell movies. Like, that's like, what, you want like a 5% market in this Hollywood machine that also runs like all like popular black music that is deliberately destroying the entire black population in the United States? You want a little cozy corner to like get your independent film sold, and you're not going to, you know, say F the pigs because like they are up there doing that, you know?
No, I think that you've kind of maybe added apples to oranges and come up with raspberries. My point is this, that there are a number of ways to do what one must do, that choice is power. And that's what the direction, I think, of young media makers is all about, and has been a way in which independent filmmakers from past years have attacked a huge problem that is not monolithic. We can't all attack it by going to Hollywood. We can't all attack it by working for BET. We can't all attack it by having our own streaming media system in the digital age. You gotta use it all, and you gotta create some new ways to work it out. So that's my point. Narrow casting is not the answer.
And I think you're also assuming that we're talking about this black medium within Hollywood. We're talking about it excluding the Hollywood piece. We're talking about people of African descent creating narratives that they put on Civil War to celebrate African life.
What, a 5% market share?
Well, see, you're talking market share, you're talking about, and maybe because you can't see yourself out of their white system. We're not talking about it in conversation with white folks. You are. We don't have to have that conversation. We can exclude. We can have conversations about ourselves without talking about you guys. That's what we're talking about.
And on the other hand, it is a wide world. It is a global world. It's not. So co-production deals, relationships with financing from international markets, CDF, Italian television, video systems in Ghana. It's all going on. People are trying to figure out what kinds of ways we can come together to forward the messages that we feel are most important, have been misconstrued, are neglected, and perhaps we are not looking at, you know, what is my market share of this. Perhaps to some extent, if we were strictly focused on Hollywood, that would be our bottom line. But I think we're talking about a spiritual evolution of creating a sense of future and issues that are available for young people, voices to rise to the fore, for people to be respected whose histories have been totally either not represented up here or here, or have been totally distorted.
One thing is apparent from the discussion is that despite how limited mainstream filmmaking has been to the black filmmaker, black filmmakers themselves have consistently demonstrated a unique tradition of stepping outside of the box and leaping over boundaries to create cinema that reflect the range of cultural aesthetic in our community. However, these various interpretations of black life are rarely seen on the big screen. Considering that many of our American icons and heroes have come from our motion picture stars, we need to understand that what this narrow view presented often is what is interpretive of us. That's why I encourage all of those listening to go out and check out some black cinema films beyond the mainstream. You'll be surprised at how complex that book is from the movie. I hope you enjoyed today's show. As usual, you can check out replays of People, Places, and Things at www.peopleplacesthingsradio.com. Also, stay tuned to G-Town Radio for more great programming. I hope that you will join me again next week, weather permitting, of course, for another great edition of People, Places, and Things. I am your host, Shireen Ball, wishing you well. Peace.